once you figure out your school sucks moment and that, you know, there might be places you want to go in the world and the education you've got won't take you there, learn how to learn anything for yourself. It's just like if you don't go someplace because you're afraid you're going to get stuck, well, you make yourself an expert of getting unstuck, and then you can go off-road wherever you want to go.
Awesome.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Consider the art of driving. Without everybody behind the wheel, our sort of economy would be impossible. So everybody is there, IQ notwithstanding. With less than 30 hours of combined training and experience, 100 million people are allowed access to vehicular weapons more lethal than pistols or rifles. Why does our government make such presumptions of competence, placing nearly unqualified trust in drivers, while it maintains such a tight grip on near-monopoly state schooling? An analogy will illustrate just how radical this trust really is. What if I propose that we hand 3 sticks of dynamite in a detonator to anyone who asks for them? All an applicant would need is money to pay for the explosives. You'd have to be an idiot to agree with my plan, at least based on the assumptions you picked up in school about human nature and human competence. And yet gasoline, a spectacularly mischievous explosive, is available to anyone with a container. 5 gallons of gasoline have the destructive power of a stick of dynamite. The average tank holds 15 gallons, yet no background check is necessary for dispenser or dispensee. As long as gasoline is freely available, gun control is beside the point. Why do we allow access to a portable substance capable of incinerating houses, torching crowded theaters, or even turning skyscrapers into infernos? We haven't even considered the battering ram aspect of cars. Why are novice operators allowed to command a ton of metal capable of hurtling through school crossings at up to 2 miles a minute? Why do we give the power of life and death this way to everyone? It should strike you at once that our unstated official assumptions about human nature are dead wrong. Nearly all people are competent and responsible. Universal motoring proves that. The efficiency of motor vehicles as terrorist instruments would have written a tragic record long ago if people were inclined to terrorism. But almost all auto mishaps are accidents, and while there are seemingly a lot of those, the actual fraction of mishaps, when held up against the stupendous number of possibilities for mishap, is quite small. Notice how quickly people learn to drive well. Early failure is efficiently corrected, usually self-corrected, because the terrific motivation of staying alive and in one piece steers driving improvement. If the lifelong nanny rules of Owen, McClure, Pestalozzi, and Beatrice Webb, or those calls for precision in human ranking of Thorndike and Hall, or those nuanced interventions of Yale, Stanford, and Columbia Teachers College were actually as essential as their proponents claimed, this libertarian miracle of motoring would be unfathomable. Now consider the intellectual component of driving. It isn't all just hand-eye-foot coordination. First-time drivers make hundreds of continuous hypotheses, plans, computations, and fine-tuned judgment every day they drive. They do this skillfully, without being graded, because if they don't, organic provision exists in the motoring universe to punish them. There isn't any court of appeal from your own stupidity on the road. I could go on. Think of licensing, maintenance, storage, adapting machine and driver to seasons and daily conditions. Carefully analyzed, driving is as impressive a miracle as walking, talking, or reading. But this only shows the inherent weakness of analysis, since we know almost everyone learns to drive well in a few hours. The way we used to be as Americans, learning everything, breaking down social class barriers, is the way we might be again without forced schooling. Driving proves that to me.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. On October 15th, 2017, in case you haven't heard anything about this, a pretty introverted guy, a homebody, a man who's not particularly crazy about driving, embarked on a cross-country and back journey that lasted 40 days, and I will tell you, when I set out, I had no idea that we'd be able to drag it out this long. But here we are. This is the end. This is the final episode. It's Richard Grove and his friend Mark, who's actually a Montessori school teacher, interviewing Nick and me about the return trip of School Sucks Across America, the lessons learned along the way, and what shape will Nick's documentary take. Before we get to that, I wanted to talk about a theme that you're going to hear in the show today, getting outside. It's a very simple idea, but I just want to tell you how it's been meaningful to me in the process of getting ready to leave for this trip, the process of being on this trip, and some of the discoveries I've made since I've been back, and I'm still making and still figuring out how to make use of. The clip you heard at the beginning of the show was Rich from the very first episode in this series. It was called Making a Map, and it fits in with today's theme. But I also wanted to include it because being able to start and finish there is a meaningful thing for me. I think this trip and some of its outcomes have been a kind of synthesis of things that we've been talking about and things that I've been working on off the show since 2013. And this was a process that Rich helped guide me through. In the very early stages, he and Lisa opened their home to me. I spent the summer with them in 2013 when I was really not having the best time personally. And I wasn't really sure at the time how I was going to fix it. But I got in my car and I left New Hampshire. And I have to say I returned much better off. But the first phase in this new attempt at more conscious living that happened back then was about clearing the runway, being able to find a kind of presence in life. There was a lot of chaos back then, and I think it was like a week into immersing myself into the David Allen getting things done world, I felt so much better. I felt so much more capable. And as time went on, I realized, like, okay, now all this clutter is off the runway. It's at least where it needs to be, which is not in the way of takeoff. And then you can see how long the runway is, and you can see how vast the sky is beyond that. And it's overwhelming, and I think it encourages one, speaking from my own experience, to try to retreat to a comfort zone, something that I certainly did many times since then. There's an idea that I talked about with Michael Malice, with Jeff Berwick, with Tom Woods, with all of you guys, pretty much with anybody that I've talked to about School Sucks Across America. One of my motivations for going on this trip, I felt like too much of my attention was being sucked into matters that I couldn't control. It was a symptom of not living consciously, not preparing myself for certain things. And let's face it, it's not been the best couple of years for people's serenity. There's a great YouTube channel called Nerdwriter, and he recently made a video called Check Your Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is a German word for the act of taking pleasure in the misfortune of others. This has become extremely popular. In the video, he talks about how people love fail compilations, how a huge part of comedy is something happening at other people's expense, wanting to see your enemies be punished, which is why politics caters so perfectly to that Schadenfreude impulse. But we saw the emergence of this political figure, the real emergence. I mean, he first kind of emerged. I mean, he's been emerging since the 1980s. I'm talking about Donald Trump. But he really, like, emerged in 2015. And the video talks about how he meets the criteria. He's like the ideal target for Schadenfreude. He's pompous. He's, you know, deserving of misfortune. He's successful. Like, he's the kind of person that you want to see fall, which is why one of the real reasons why I think the Me Too movement is so popular and just even general celebrity eats shit kind of news. The gratification of Schadenfreude comes from a need to feel better about oneself, ego, even maybe a kind of not so accurate definition of self-esteem. And I talked about before I left staring into a screen, a box. And that box was a kind of window to the world. And because I wasn't being diligent, and because I wasn't living consciously, pushing my energy and attention into the horrors and the amusement of the world, it started to have some kind of toxic effects. And before I left on this trip, I was spending the summer doing some kind of unhealthy behavior. I'll give you an example. I had people that I would search on Facebook because, and they weren't any of you guys. They were, you know, people from high school, people from college, people with very different political ideas from mine. And I would search them and go to their Facebook pages just so I could see what their next Trump-born comedic meltdown was going to be about. And I think when I got out on the road and I stopped like doing as much, I mean, like the only time I had for social media was to make those posts at the end of every day. And I kind of removed myself from that world. I started to realize like, what does that say about how I was feeling about myself? And why was I feeling that way? And there was a contrast to engage in that kind of behavior, finding amusement in other people's freakouts, anger, and confusion. I really don't believe, certainly I don't want to believe, that that's representative of who I am. But contrast that to being out in the real world and driving for maybe, 200 hours through that real world. I found myself pretty much steadily rooting for people not to fuck up, not to be overtaken by confusion or anger. Because none of that's really a form of entertainment on the highway. And the more I kind of contrasted these two experiences, these bizarre Facebook searches to watch meltdowns, and generally hoping for the best for people in the real world, I felt pretty disappointed in myself. That in this particular way, I feel like I was failing to embrace a lesson that I've tried to teach 100 times. I let myself be sucked into a kind of box, this screen, that requires a lack of perspective, that requires a surrender of, you know, any kind of personal empowerment, that is a kind of mental prison. A while after I'd been back, I went to the gym and I got on the treadmill. And the treadmills at my gym have these little TVs where if you want to watch the news, you get a choice between CNN and MSNBC. So following a kind of old impulse, I turned on CNN as a form of entertainment. It was Anderson Cooper. It used to be called 360. I think the new name is the Doom Porn Jackoff Hour. And it was shithole day. Trump and shithole in every lower third through the entirety of what I was hoping would be a serene walk. And I realized this is not entertainment. Anybody who's watching this is just engaging in a kind of confirmation bias, self-inflicted emotional torture. And I was reminded of the Nerdwriter video that the media, once they see this thing that people experience and engage in but won't talk about, they won't name it, they won't make explicit, this idea of the Schadenfreude. Every form of mainstream and social media says, okay, fuckers, if that's what you want, here you go. That's what happens in school. That's what bullying is all about. And when you're kind of imprisoned, if that's not too strong a word, you don't feel good. And you get lethargic and uninspired. So then you want to feel better, but as long as it's not too much work. So in comes the joy and the misfortune of others to the rescue. And I thought about this. Here I am, 40 years old, in some ways still schooled. The boxes that are so easy to fall into have a kind of comfort and regularity and security. So I felt real nice and real superior in the past when I've pointed out that for most people, it's just one Skinner box after another, forgetting that I'm also a human who is susceptible to that. Somewhere along the way on my trip, like first couple weeks, I was shooting a time lapse while I was driving, and it reminded me of a video that I made in 2013 called The Art of Driving. It was based on John Taylor Gatto's writing from 1999. It's in the Underground History of American Education. You actually heard the audio from that video at the beginning of this show. So anyway, I got to a hotel. I sat on the bed. I rewatched this video because I'm like, well, I'll take my time-lapse footage and remake it, and that would be neat. Unfortunately, I don't currently have the computing power to edit 4K video, and the window of time is kind of closed on that. So I'm glad I could like at least reinsert the ideas into this show before we move on. Because God is so optimistic, you know? He's talking about what's really out there in the world is goodness and competence and kindness. So reject the quote-unquote assumptions you picked up in school. The assumptions that for me were being reinforced day in and day out by how I was living. And I'm not trying to tell this as if I'm the, you know, protagonist in the allegory of the cave, coming back to you and saying, hey, everybody, it's okay out there. Come on, let's go outside. Right? We all live in the real world every day. You people live more in the real world than I do. Right? So much of what I saw along the way, and even something that I've tried to experience a little bit since I've been back in New Hampshire, are these amazing communities of people connected around, you know, common interest or philosophy or, you know, the education of their children. And those kinds of things are, I think if I had that, I would be more able to reject those assumptions that I picked up in school. But I lived very alone in many ways before I went on that trip. And my need for connection and extension into the world, I was trying to satisfy it through the screen, and with the screen comes the box. And for me, maybe this doesn't resonate with you, but for me, the contrast, which happened pretty much overnight, removing myself from the world of the Schadenfreude and the operant conditioning, and moving into the actual world, day in, day out, eye contact, connected communication, seeing how easy it is to quickly get over the discomfort of, you know, meeting strangers, but also seeing from one place to another, over and over and over again, the kinds of communities that reflect Gatto's optimism. For years, you know this, I've told you about this, I've tried to fill my life with, you know, a good diet, exercise, helpful routines. But as I compare, and I've done a lot of this since I've been back, my states of mind, September, October, and something that I've fallen into since I've been back, if I compare that state of mind to what I was experiencing while I was on this trip, I have to say it's exposed a pretty significant divide between the life that I've been living and the kind of life that I want to have. I've realized there's a lot that's missing, and I've been finding some pretty clever ways to overlook all of that. And that takes me to lesson two. I was kind of disappointed by this realization that I had on the road. I mean, I'm happy that I had it. I'm happy that I'm now aware of it. That in some ways, I had fallen into the very types of boxes that I try to warn people about on this show through unconscious living in certain areas, or the failure to recognize certain unmet needs that I was having. But I'm also aware of the fact that I have plenty of experience doing that all by myself. And that is about comfort. For so much of my life, the comfort zone has been a really essential location. Anxiety, fear, hypochondria. Hypochondria that's so bad sometimes that even though I don't even actually have it, I think I do, folks. And from that, I sought escape. And as I talked about with Jeff Berwick, booze was perfect for that. It's actually terrible for that. But in the moment, in that kind of desperation where you'll trade the future for comfort now, it seems pretty ideal. And because of that, I only had like two places to live, a comfort zone and an overwhelm zone. Because I didn't really embrace a kind of discomfort in the middle. You know, it produced symptoms of physical stress. It was one or the other. You know, I knew that I couldn't just keep tolerating life as it was. So I would make these, you know, grand plans, usually after like a drinking bender. I would say, okay, now we're going to get in shape. We're going to journal. We're going to do all these. I mean, this goes back to, you know, my early 20s, you know, and I'd put a plate on a stick and I'd start spinning it. And I'd say, if I can spin one, I can spin two. If I can spin three, I can spin four. And before I knew it, I was overwhelmed again. Because there never, I don't think there'd really ever been any reward for embracing the thing that's in between comfort and overwhelm. Since I got back, I've been less of a homebody. I've been trying to socialize more. I've got a poker night. Now, as a non-drinker, playing with drinkers, that's actually going pretty well for me financially. Trivia night. I've been going to the Coastal Freestater meetups, trying to immerse myself in that community a little bit. There's lots of really, really good people there. And Sunday, I was at this monthly event they do called the Powwow. And people can get up and they can give brief, you know, talks about something they're working on or something that's been on their mind. And this guy, Mike, I don't want to use his whole name because it was kind of an intimate gathering. But his topic was moral courage. And even though I've like embraced what he said before he said it, he clarified it in a way that I thought was really helpful. Instead of the two zones that I spent most of my life in, comfort and overwhelm, he talked about three. a comfort zone and the overwhelm zone, but in between it, a kind of challenge zone. And the difference between eustress and distress. When you struggle with the emotional and physical symptoms of anxiety, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell the difference between those two. So whatever that uncomfortable feeling was, I didn't want to embrace it. And if I wasn't willing to embrace it, I wasn't going to really realize that there also needed to be a balance between like discomfort and realistic expectations. Like I spent so much of my 20s and my 30s just revving up and crashing because I couldn't make use of that space in the middle. I was talking to Tony Myers, my good friend of the show, about this idea. And he said, yeah, it's like the yin and the yang. The two sides, the black and the white, chaos and serenity, but there's a line in the middle. And that's the path that you have to walk. And I know some of you who are more experienced, maybe older, more well-traveled, you've been in the military. You might be listening to all this and saying, yeah, congratulations, dude, you went on a trip in a car. But since I've been back, that comfort zone is super uncomfortable in all areas of life. And when I do fall into it, I'm very keenly aware of it. Shortly after I came back, I created for myself a kind of imaginary friend, and I made him my boss. And he is called 50-year-old Brett Vinat. And as I go through this kind of process of uncovering these really difficult things and looking at them and experiencing them and strategizing how they're going to be addressed, how they're going to be solved, there's some of it that certainly makes me wish that 30-year-old Brett Vinat had me as an imaginary boss, if you will. And as I look at the ominousness or the ugliness of some of these things, there's some empathy for that younger self. I totally understand why I buried this. But there's something very satisfying about feeling like I'm getting to the final only I will knows of life. That's a reference to Brandon's warning, you know, about self-image. Don't tell yourself it's okay because only I will know. Because in the end, you are the only person who will matter. But earlier, I was talking about, you know, the gratitude that I have towards Rich and the path that he helped me get on over 4 years ago. And I said it's kind of been a synthesis of a lot of the things that we've been working on for years on this show. And of course, that involves the six pillars. It involves ACEs. It involves internal family systems. It involves that series of shows that I did with Bill Buppert on Stoicism. But actually, one of the things that I'm finding most helpful right now is where this all began, with the productivity conversations, more specifically about the kind of organization that needs to take place in order to solve problems and produce things that are meaningful. If this confrontation with some of these only I will knows, or some of these things that have been buried, had to be limited to the confines of my own mind, I would slowly go berserk. But that's the place where it usually takes place, right? As David Allen said, you know, the head can have ideas all day, but it can't hold them in a really constructive way, and it sure as shit can't organize them. So as we try to hug some of this cacti, Robert Downey Jr.'s metaphor about dealing with addiction, or whatever problem, it has to be externalized. It has to be written about. It has to be talked about. This week I've made tables, spreadsheets, brain models. But getting the stuff in front of the eyes, out of the mind and in front of the eyes, putting it somewhere where it becomes concrete, you can almost always find the way to identify the next action and start moving forward. And that's what I've been doing lately on, you know, the very things that I put off the longest and buried the deepest. And again, the externalization process helps with that because, oh, you fill up with shitty things. Because my head is like this fight between rational ideas and uncomfortable emotions. And if you can separate those things into categories, paper is great for this. It's helped me make some very important, good decisions. Once it's out, it's real. And once it's real for me, it's something that I have to, it's like a kind of accountability I have to talk to somebody else about, more than one person, ideally. I'm fortunate that through what I do, I've built a really, really good network of friends who have tons of wisdom and understanding. And I'm very grateful for that. So as I separate the uncomfortable emotions from the more rational assessments, there's pain, there's regret, there's frustration, but it's balanced by a kind of satisfaction in right action. The actions that are most in line with my well-being, with my self-respect, and with the six pillars too. I think that's really important. So I hope some of you found that helpful. Some production notes before we get started. This show, it was about 2 hours, and a lot of it really didn't serve my purposes for the conclusion of this. I started editing it and extracting parts of it until I'd almost cut it in half. So unfortunately, one thing that I couldn't do anything about is there's going to be a couple of callbacks that aren't going to make sense if you don't hear the whole version. The line, "How did Oswald do that?" And then everybody laughs, but you have no idea what's being talked about. It's explained in a 20-minute pre-show. If you're listening to the Patreon version, just keep listening. It's at the end of this. There was one point that I was trying to make that got really muddled. You have, you know, four people talking. Everybody's coming to the issue with, you know, different viewpoints and different goals. And I couldn't reorder the pieces of the conversation or really fix it in editing, so it just got pulled out of the show. That's also in the Patreon version. It will also be on the AV Club. And a good prologue to this conversation is the most recent installment in the series before this one. It is on the front page of the website right now. It's called The Deep End, number 24. It's me, Richard Grove, and Kevin Cole from day two in the very same studio, but on the complete other end of the trip. And I got a lot of really great feedback about that discussion, so I recommend it. It was recorded October 16th. Even though we were talking about current events, there were some connections that I think are timeless, and some of the analysis of those current events has actually become increasingly relevant since then. So I really recommend you check it out either on our Patreon page or at schoolsucksproject.com in the AV Club. If you want to support this show, and I would appreciate it if you did, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks and make a pledge there, or you can go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV. And of course, I want to say thank you to the people who already do that, the people who made this great adventure and future adventures possible. And I just want to take a minute to thank all of the kind and generous people who helped out on the way from New Hampshire to Los Angeles, including Nick Ryder, Mark Edge, Rich and Lisa, of course, Philip Figueredo, Phil Serdum, Ben Dasher, Tony Myers, Mandrick, Jamin and Karen Baconic, Drew Sample, Devin Fraze, Daniel McCarthy, Alana Colson, Dana Smith, Alex Bell, Michael Patrick Slomzenski, Joseph Motard, Daniel Allen, Sarah Wassinger, Kevin Cole, Gabe and Ann Minisk Ryder, Jared and Shauna Hine, Megan Rasko, Eric Belzy, Paul Duane, Webmaster Tony and his wife Gina, and finally, oh gosh, Christian and Tess, and Darren and Micaiah. Two couples I don't think they've ever met, but they all helped to make my Bay Area experience truly spectacular. They were islands of sanity and stability in a sea of poo-throwing communist lunatics, but I'm exaggerating. And I also want to say thank you to everyone who hosted, fed, and provided support to Nick Ulbrich and myself on the return trip, including Donna and Ernest Hancock, Michael and Kristen Irwin, Jamie and Cindy Ellis Crane, Carrie McLean, Larry Sherman, and of course, Rich and Lisa again. Huge thanks to Nick Ulbrich for his serenity and patience as he spent 11 days in a car with the fatigued and somewhat homesick version of me. And thank you so much to all the awesome and inspirational people that I encountered on this journey. There's too many to name before this song ends, but you folks were absolutely one of the most important aspects of this trip. To borrow Larkin Rose's concept of candles in the dark, it's amazing what so many of you are doing and how you're working to light up the areas around you with the ideas of liberty and self-directed education. So many of you inspired me, and you've made me very excited about the future. Here we go.
Okay, I'll answer for real. If I found myself stranded on an island with 6 million girls, well, I'd put them all to work. We'd build a kick-ass sailboat to get me back to you. See, I'm not fucking around.
So let's go back to what is the thesis then?
What are some of the topic areas that you call
Brett's those driving things? Techniques?
Yeah. We talk a lot about self-education and home education on my show. And I thought if I went across the country and actually came face to face and was able to put, you know, cameras, mostly microphones, but sometimes cameras, up to the people who actually do these things, I could make a lot of the stuff that we've talked about on the show really concrete, you know, mm-hmm. and really concrete for myself too. But also, you know, on a personal side, less than a professional side, if I could see how School Sucks actually influence people, that was something that after 8 years of doing this, I kind of needed, because in the, like the more libertarian political conversation, there's not enough people talking about education. Just in the whole what's wrong with America business, there's not enough people talking about education. And, you know, at this point, I'm a little frustrated where, you know, 2016, everyone just goes back to politics. Everyone just goes back to projecting all of their energy and attention into things that they never will be able to have any influence in, into areas where they have no actual power. And, you know, one of the reasons why I was able to do something like this is because I said, I can't do anything about that. The thing I can change is me. The thing I can change is how I learn, how I live, my relationships, my professional freedom.
And can you put thinking in between stimulus and response?
Exactly. In more and more situations, right? Because we say, can we make a space between stimulus and response when it comes to like watching the news? So do I watch CNN and go, oh, that's true, or oh, that makes me angry like they want it to? No, so we started by being able to put the space there. But then, like, can I put the space there in personal areas of my life? Life isn't going well. I want to get drunk. I'm going to get drunk, right? Or can I put a space there and say, well, no, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe I should actually kind of face the fire and push through this difficult situation. And maybe there's growth and opportunity that comes from that. So what I learned, I guess, from just learning this quote from him, maybe in like 2010.
We thought it was a Viktor Frankl quote.
Yeah, it's not, interestingly enough.
Because I went to use it or quote it in my book. And I was like, what is the source for that? I think it's, you know, the meaning of meaning or something like that was the title of his book.
And Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search yeah. for Meaning. And it's not in there. And so then you find people discussing it on the internet. And apparently Stephen Covey said something about Viktor Frankl to the tune of, in between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space is your freedom, right? And I add, to think or not to think, right? Because that's what's going on. Either it's a reaction, stimulus reaction, or it's stimulus thinking response. And the difference is between being controlled by the culture mm-hmm. and the Trump and the Hillary and all this stuff, or being like, oh, wait a minute, what is all this about? Why are they trying to put everyone at odds with each other all of a sudden when we all got along just fine a couple years ago?
So a holistic re-education of oneself is like, there's lots of people who are in the wake up people business, you know, right. saying, hey, everyone needs to wake up. So they're saying, look, I figured out how to put a space between the stimulus of what I'm supposed to believe, or the stimulus of what the news says, or the stimulus of what the school says, and actually coming to what I think is a reasoned decision, whether it is or it isn't. But can you do that, you know, in aspects of your own life? I think is really important.
Well, even right there, like, we see reason as like, reason's an important thing, but there's also things that fall outside of the realm of reason that are good inputs to have, like the emotion.
Sure.
The energy around you, like that's input that schools automatically, very quickly, try to condition out of kids.
Well, would school ever use embarrassment to keep a kid in line? Right? That's the type of thing that's going on. It's like it's not being used to teach. It's being used to control kids. And they use fear a lot in school, I think.
Well, I mean, that's coming from a super hierarchical, like way up the line. Way up the line, though. Like that type of thought is way up the line. When you, like, right at the base level, like right in the trenches, so to speak, are some good people who really care about kids.
At the beginning of their careers, generally. I mean, I bet there are some people who make it all the way through. For example, my fourth grade teacher is teaching my nephew this year.
Still the same curriculum, too, I'm sure.
No. This guy, your
fourth grade teacher?
My fourth grade, and I'm 40, right? So my fourth grade teacher is teaching my 9-year-old nephew this year. And that's pretty amazing. He's got to be close to 70 years old. He was the best public school teacher I ever had. He read us The Hobbit. He took us outside. Fourth grade, he said, boys, fourth grade boys, they need to be outside.
Yeah.
He'd say, go outside and build something, you know, and he'd supervise us because he had to. But he was so involved. He gave us so much free time to explore, to interact with each other. He was unlike any other teacher that I had in elementary school. he is such, he is like the Jaime Escalante character, though. Is it, you know, Jaime Escalante?
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Stand and deliver?
Stand and deliver.
Now, people have, when I've complained about like teachers and the bureaucracy and the failure of school, they say, Jaime Escalante, that's a true story. Like, yeah, it was a movie. It was a movie for a reason, you know? It's not that they don't make a movie about the guy who takes quarters at the toll booth, because everybody at the toll booth takes quarters. Yeah. They make a movie about Jaime Escalante because in that profession, he's extraordinary. Right. Most people don't do that. And the experience that I had as a student for 12 years, but also in a fairly short career as an educator, people come in, they're very idealistic. When we're getting trained to be teachers, they're all saying, education is going to be student-centered, and we're doing away with the old model of top-down controls and standardized tests, and we're going to build classrooms from the bottom up. They talk like the people who teach these classes, whether it's just like certification or master's program, they talk like Maria Montessori.
Yeah.
Right. They talk like the people who founded the Sudbury School, but they're just like generating. I don't think they know they're doing it because they're teachers, so they don't know anything. They're trapped in a bubble of academia, but they have all these idealistic visions of what they think education should be. So they fill the heads of young teachers with it, and those teachers go into the school and they try to do it in the public school.
And then they find out.
And then 20 years later, those are the people who put on the video and fall asleep.
Well, there's an assumption there that the children are just there to learn academics. Like, that's not what they're all there for. Some of them are learning how to make friends. Some of them are learning how to talk to people.
Like, the assumption coming from where?
From academia. Like, the training is usually just an academic training. Like, the actual person-to-person interaction with a young person who's 9 years old and how to connect with that person as a person, not mm-hmm. as a teacher student,
not as a bucket to dump information into.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, that's, we talked about this before we were recording, the academics problem. Like, the school system is always designed and updated by academics and bureaucrats.
Well, and who, how's and, it funded too?
Well, there, but there's that. But the Ken Robinson, the famous Ken Robinson video, where he's
TED Talk.
Well, yeah, on Sir creativity. And he says, he uses this great visual of academics or people who only see their bodies as things to carry their head from one meeting to another.
Yeah. A part of what was spoken about in California, in LA, but also a part of the purpose of this trip, and therefore, to some extent, the synthesis or the thesis of this trip.
That's very Hegelian of you. Is, although he never said that either.
Is, well, I mean, there's ways to read.
You're gonna
Hegel.
Skip over my Hegel joke? Well, it's hard to break out. First off.
In the sense of the thesis is get outside the four walls. Like, we were talking about this. 20 years of your life from 6 to 26, you're in some kind of four-walled room.
System.
Yeah.
Sure.
But it's not just a system. I mean, the system is the social construct within those four walls. I'm simply just talking about the fact that you're in four walls.
Mm.
So think about those kids who come from, like, you know, the Rothschild's children, for example, who have oodles of money. They put their kids on a cruise boat and send them around the world for 12 years, and that's right. Their education. You know, sure, they're going to learn math, but they're going to learn math in Greece, where they can go to the Parthenon and they can look at busts of Pythagoras.
Right.
And learn about people and how they behave and how they think. And they're able to take that step back where most of us were put into a big mix of children. We're developing our egos with all this stuff going on, and it's a difficult thing.
Well, a false metric of success, because it's like the grading system and that whole thought.
Right.
Here's the thing. I mean, this is what it is. And like, the trip is almost a representation of this school to society idea. The schools promise that they'll make good citizens, right? They certainly do that. They put you in a place from 6 to 18 years old where they teach you you need to be watched, you know, not to trust yourself, that you need to obey, that you need to conform. And after all of that training, you go out into the world and you're a damn good citizen. But in that structure, That's not natural human behavior. That's human beings in captivity. Most kids don't want to be surrounded by concrete walls all day, especially at a time in life when they need to be moving and having positive interactions. I mean, bullying happens in places where people are forced to be together. That creates an attitude, I think, about humans and about society. And I think it influences how a person looks at his or herself. Now, when I leave to go on this trip, I find myself sitting in a room all day. It's just called my office, right? Not looking out the window, looking into a computer screen,
right?
Which is how I view the world, through a Facebook newsfeed, through Twitter, through YouTube. And I'm saying to myself, God, everybody's a fucking asshole. This world is fucked, you know? And then I go on the Rothschild cruise, essentially.
Yeah.
And I learned that...
Take the tour.
Almost everybody is delightful.
Right.
That people are, you know, welcoming and friendly.
And generous.
And there's a ton of stuff to be grateful for.
And willing to take you around town and show you the sights.
Well, there's... But even complete strangers.
Sure.
You know? And that this country is just absolutely beautiful.
So you're
saying bountiful.
It's not like they show us on TV all the time?
And well, no, I mean, you think about the, you know, you picture, like I went to all of these places, and if I just say a name, I bet, like, imagery comes to your mind. Oklahoma.
Flat.
Well, imagery comes to my mind, but that's because we have a shared experience.
That's because we've been there, and we know it's awesome.
And that was the thing, even in a place like Oklahoma...
Yeah,
you know, where we essentially went there to, you know, be a bit silly on the trip.
Yeah.
You know, but even going to the duck hunting banquet called Ducks Unlimited that we went to.
Gun auction.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener. I think, you know, how much education can you efficiently get in 15 to 20 seconds walking into a Ducks Unlimited duck hunting banquet auction? You know, and you're never going to get that same visceral type of education from within textbooks. Now, that's not to say that book learning is unimportant. Like, my life is built around book learning. That, again, gets back to Brett's euphemism, which is school is a tube. And in that tube, what is happening is it's not a tube. It's a tunnel. It's a concrete fucking tunnel. That you're walking down at gunpoint, essentially. Because what happens if your family isn't quite educated in terms of the alternatives to, you know, what we call education in this country, in my country, you know, the school system? What happens if your child stops going to school? You know, people show up at your house, knock on your door, and sometimes they're carrying guns.
What happens if you stop paying for the schools? The property taxes here won't pay for schools. So if you stop paying for the school, they take your house.
Exactly.
That's some important state apparatus right there.
So, but that's the thing. So we start this documentary. We're at the end of the documentary now. We're at the end of the trip. This is what, day 40?
Day 40.
Mm-hmm. Day 40. This is it. So we can now look back on it, and we can now pick at it and say that was a really big turning point, or whatever it happens to be. So we start this whole trip at the house of Ernie Hancock, who's famous for declaring his independence and saying, "Freedom's the answer, what's the question?" You know, but the question is school. And how do you get from the school to the freedom? Well, that's where the people that we interviewed, the people that we talked to, you know, I think we met three or four homeschoolers along the way, maybe more. And
well, you certainly met a bunch on the way out, right?
Probably 20 or more on the way out. Right.
Yeah.
More than maybe 40 or more on the way out.
But the other thing we tapped into, which is really important, is that a lot of this community isn't necessarily aware of Brett. And Brett isn't necessarily aware of the wider community. So, you know, I think what the thesis of this film is about is opportunity. Opportunity is outside. You're not going to find it. I mean, you are going to find it. You are going to find it when you go outside and you do something and you come back and you report it to YouTube, you know, you're going to find opportunity in that context or a podcast. But even a podcast can be a roamcast. You can set up a rig and go and be outside to record your podcast.
He does it when he goes on walks and stuff.
Yeah. So
Mark could be podcasting when he jogs in the morning.
Yeah. So outside is the opportunity. Now, what do you want to envisage outside as? Because I think in what we've shot, we can show outside as being different in different contexts. So think outside the square. Or just think outside, period.
Placidus, New Mexico. We meet an unschooling family. They have an 8-year-old daughter. Their backyard is this arroyo. Now,
is unschooling what people have to do after they leave school and homeschool?
Usually that's called de-schooling.
De-schooling. But how would you define unschooling?
Unschooling is is applying to children the way adults teach themselves. Adults say, I'm interested in something. I need to figure out how to learn it. Letting kids do that when they have the absolute most energy and their brains are probably like between the ages of, I mean, as far as like learning more complex things between the ages of like 8 and 14. So where I don't like using anything that has the word schooling in it. School can do schooling, as Lorette Lynn said, you know, if you want school, they have a place for that.
Yeah.
So we don't talk about homeschooling and even unschooling, still using the word schooling.
So Ron Paul needs to update his brand name.
So we started using home education, but even using the word home, you picture people just sitting at the kitchen table with books.
Yeah.
So I like self-directed learning. I like real-world education. Yeah. And this girl was doing both in her backyard. She gave us a tour of the New Mexico landscape. She told us what the trees were. She told us what the rocks were. She showed us what we could forage in the area. And her mom said to me and Nick, you know, we want her to walk on these paths, like for safety.
Yeah.
And she said, I don't want to walk on the paths, right?
Right.
Now, school is even more extreme. I think if all of us went to public school and went to college, Nick said the tunnel or the tube, right? You go through this tube. It's one way. At the beginning, you're dumb and useless. And as you're pushed through it, mm-hmm. there's no way out. I mean, if you do manage to go out of the tube somehow along the way, you just wind up working at McDonald's. So you push through the tube and push through the tube with the promise that the light at the end of the tube is worthiness, success,
job,
happiness, right. Employability. That's how most of us viewed education, as a path through a tunnel. And I go out and I interact with all these people who've never even been in the tunnel. Right. And they view education as a panorama. It's 360 degrees.
Yeah.
It's a vista. And they even realize they have this kind of confidence as learners and this self-assuredness and this, you know, not just intellectual, but emotional self-defense, especially by the time a lot of them are teenagers, that they go, you know what? Tube's got a lot of stuff in it. If I need to go get something out of the tube, I'll do it. You know, if the high school has the good chorus program, I'll go to the high school and take that out of the tube, you know, and then I can come back out of the tube. Or if I want to play football, I'll go in the tube just to play football, you know?
Yeah. And the other interesting thing.
So that's I think that's like the outside idea that you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And the other interesting thing about going back into the tube is I think we were in Knoxville when Sherry was explaining that her daughter wanted to go back to school.
Yeah.
Went back to school, really didn't like school, wanted to come back home, which was fine, but actually worked a way that she could just go to school during football or whatever the sport was.
Mm-hmm.
So she actually was a student and she was only required to turn up for what she wanted to turn up for anyway, which was the game. And then the other really, I think, powerful part of this idea is the flip side of it. When we were in Richmond, there was a gentleman there who hated school so viscerally that his parents, for his safety, took him out and homeschooled him. And then he had to go back because they couldn't continue it. But he'd had enough of a glimpse. It was Plato's cave analogy.
Right.
That he had enough of a glimpse after the bright light burned his eyes, to be able to recognize what things were. And so when he went back into the cave, into the tube, into the tunnel, what happened was he realized that work at his own speed. He could basically graduate early. And he just went to the office and asked for the files and worked out a system that suited himself. Now, he was laughed at by the principal and the vice principal when he asked to do it. But he did it, and he graduated early. So there's, like, the spectrum. How much of the vista does someone need to see? You know, someone watching this right now, perhaps the thesis should be, you don't need to change your lifestyle drastically tomorrow to get the benefits of self-directed learning. It can actually be a gradual transfer. You can carefully find a way out that benefits or maximizes the benefits of while you're still in the tube and while you're outside the tube.
So is there any way that the people that you met along the journey can talk to each other? Because my first thought is that kid should talk to Nick Hazelton. Because that's what people need.
Columbus, Ohio.
It's like, you're not the first person to figure out that this might be bullshit and you could be better using your life. And if you get your parents' permission, you could get out of school, start your own business, and have like an advantage instead of waiting and saying, I have a piece of paper, will you hire me? Because that's a very competitive market these days, right?
Well, that reminds me of another analogy. And this is quick, so Brett, you can get to your point. When we were leaving Richmond to get to New York, we knew that the traffic was going to be horrendous because it was the day before Thanksgiving. So this is day 39. And we got 6 hours to drive. So,
I talked to him yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And I said, that's a cool route. I've driven that many times. And I did it once on Thanksgiving Eve. And I said, I hope it's not as bad.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, it came up in discussion. One of us asked the question, basically together we got onto this idea that how many people are in their cars right now traveling this route who have just put in their destination the GPS and they're just doing what the GPS tells them without even thinking
about it. And everyone else in the car is watching a video, so no one's paying attention. None of those people even have paper maps anymore.
Yeah,
that's the thing, man. Because those GPS and all that stuff, that's transient.
We didn't have paper maps. We tried to
just go like this.
I think you
on
did.
I go like this on the GPS and create a paper map.
Yeah.
I thought we gave you maps before you left.
No, I didn't take them.
So what we worked out is that even, and this is the analogy back to school, is even if all you do is realize that everybody around you is just blindly following the GPS, then you've at least got that choice, you know, that space between stimulus and response, where you can say, well, this is my fight to fight, and you can go through that traffic. Or you can say, well, if a good proportion of people are just following the GPS, if I don't follow the GPS, I'm going to be out of their way, and they're going to be out of mine.
Right. And there's old roads in this country, and the GPS still works on those. And it's almost like the George Costanza method. Yeah. All you had to do is the opposite of what you...
Yeah.
Well, you're being told by the technology. The GPS says go this way. It looks like everyone else has been told the same thing by the GPS.
Right.
And usually right next to the highway, there's another road, and it's just got red lights. Because before those highways were built in the Eisenhower era, there were roads. Like, you could take Route 1 all the way up to Maine.
Yeah.
And right next to Route 1 is usually like 95. That's how it works, like in Jersey and Connecticut.
So, unfortunately, a lot of those long distance roads now, they run over the interstates, right? Like, at times they run into each other.
Yeah.
So the really, like, congestion, the high volume traffic spills out onto those roads. So at one point, we have success, right? Driving through the day, I say we're taking Route 17 instead of going through Washington D.C. We go out through the Virginia countryside. We're driving through farmland as the sun is setting. Yeah. It's magical.
Yeah.
So then I was like, yep, we did it. And I go, all right, back to the GPS, right? Sends me right back to 95. Now, granted, I mean, 100 miles north of where we were, but right back to what it thinks is the best route. And we're in traffic.
Google knows how much traffic's on that road.
But it can't update until the traffic gets close. It can't update your time.
But they know, man. They're counting those cars. They give you like the traffic congestion. Yeah. And
so I kept trying to do that same move, like looking for alternate roads. And Nick fell asleep at one point and he wakes up and I'm going, fuck, fuck, fuck. Because I thought I could find another side road and it was also like bumper to bumper traffic.
Is that when you guys tried to call me?
No, I always want to like calm down before I. call you. I don't want to stress you out. Not that you're stressed out.
No, you. But if you would have gotten stuck down there, I would have called my dad because they used to live in Richmond. And he used to have to drive up there, and he hates 95 and won't touch that. So he knows all those side roads.
Yeah. I know we're being literal now, but if we think about the analogy again, and we bring it back to what we're talking about with every person is an individual, therefore they need an individual education. Now, a lot of that is going to overlap with various people, for example, learning the native language so that you can communicate, and that, you know, and the various cultural aspects of communication, right. Like
how to hail a cab, I mean, call Uber, I mean, whatever that app does.
Yeah, so it's like what we share in common is important to understand and learn in the same way that, or a very similar well-worn method. But at the same time, you can get sucked into that and think that that's the only way. The thing is, everybody's unique. And in a thousand little ways already, right? Think about YouTube and think about all those kids right now in high school who, as soon as they get home, have YouTube open and have access to how-to videos. Or even if they're like stupid videos that you think, like, from our perspective, oh, that's why would you waste your time watching that? That, you know, like watching a couple play The Sims, for example.
Sure.
Right? You're still learning something. And, you know, you're learning how to communicate in the new economic era more than anything else. So it's kind of like we're just at a point now where I think there's enough erosion within the existing school structure, it's not going to be able to keep pace. It just simply won't.
Well, I think that's a function of the internet.
Wait,
the internet makes
doesn't matter.
Like, what are you talking about? Like, talking about the school structure system collapsing,
I'm just talking about gradually over time, and where I think it's going to start, and where I think it's important to start is. It's going to be really small. You're going to have to look for it yourself. But the people involved in it are going to feel it very acutely. And that's within various schools of universities. So, you know, we talk about the Yale Drama School. Well, how many people, and that's an in-joke basically saying that Yale as an entire campus is a school for learning to be dramatic. But, you know, you look at the social sciences or you look at even the STEM subjects, right? How many people are enrolling year after year? And what's the percentage number that it needs to decline by for one particular school to really feel the pinch, you know?
And what do they do? Or maybe that's why you ask, does it matter?
Like, there just seems to be too much of ego and people's energy being put into this system that it's this erosion that you're talking about is only for people who are already awake to.
You're saying some people would never even admit it to themselves?
There's a lot of careers, money.
It's a generation thing as well, though, don't forget. So those people who have invested their ego that way will die. Now, do their children have, it's like a photocopy. How many times can you photocopy before the message is lost? Right. So do those children who have grown up on YouTube and Google and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and maybe especially Twitter, because they, whether they agree with the politics or they don't agree with the politics, whatever it happens to be, they saw the way that Twitter was used really powerfully for the Arab Spring. And we can argue over the conspiracy side of that for sure. But what I'm saying is, from the average person's use of Twitter, they've just realized how powerful this device is. And when a school,
if it doesn't censor your tweets.
Yeah, but when has a group of schools ever caused a revolution to overthrow a political leader?
Cambodia.
I think there needs to be clearer, better tools that are used like YouTube and Twitter. Like, YouTube is not yet quite synonymous. Like, I get your point and I agree with you, but YouTube is not synonymous with, like, self-education yet. I think if we looked up the 100... if we looked up the 100 most popular YouTubers, as far as, like, our vision is concerned, we'd probably be disappointed. We'd probably be disappointed with the American public.
Well, I wouldn't be, though. And this is the argument. because it actually doesn't matter what they're watching on YouTube. The point is the level of stimulation they get from that and the on-demand nature of it and just the amount of time that they spend on it building habits, YouTube habits, that they then can't transfer into the school system during the day when they're having their phones confiscated.
Oh, yeah. Right. That's a good point. Right. Like they're it's like I've said a couple of times along the trip, there's lots of 10-year-olds in America, right, who sit there watching the Cartoon Network from like 6:30 to 7 in the morning, where there's over 100 cuts per minute, right, you know, in the editing.
That's my
and
point.
There's bright flashes.
Right.
And there's what they're watching this while they're sitting there eating a bowl of sugar that right. came out of a box
there's
that says
two emotional triggers being right. touched right there.
And then they have a phone or an iPad for kids or whatever that with the touch of a button they can do whatever they can immediately change their visual environment. And then at 8 o'clock, they're sitting in a desk completely still. Like school is, if that's what you're talking about, I totally agree that school is kind
and then
of like
they're cut
doomed.
Off from that communication because the schools don't want them using their phones.
Exactly.
Their
right. They confiscate the right. phones or all these learning opportunities that school is almost willfully blind to. And it can't stay that way. So yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. School is doomed. People are going to, it's just the effectiveness of it won't work. It's going to segregate the society, and maybe that's what we're already seeing with all the polarization.
School sucks, and it's doomed.
Well, my pushback to that is school was doomed in 1970, right?
Wasn't it doomed when they deviated from education into schooling?
Well, no. When the factory started closing, school the model as it existed was doomed. Mm. This is a process and an environment that is preparing people for a world that doesn't exist anymore. But it still exists.
The system still exists because the people who are able to navigate it well end up with the high-paying jobs. They end up in the places of power. They end up as lawyers. They end up as judges. They end up as all the people who make the decisions on how things should happen.
Right.
So all the people making decisions, they're thinking, well, works for me.
And they find their way up the system to preserve it. So right. How does this university get funding? Maybe I should move my way up and make sure they have funding to keep doing it.
So we're talking about solutions? Like I heard you say solutions. That's what I was thinking about.
I guess this is important in that conversation. That's why we've been having it the whole way along this trip.
Mm-hmm.
Is because what is that solution?
It's got to be one that incorporates the current structure and the vision for the next model.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like we can talk about homeschooling and individualized education, but the reality is in an inner city or in a suburb, you've got parents who've got to work and they can't homeschool.
That's what we saw.
Yeah.
Is how many different creative options there are. And that myth needs
both
to
parents
be
parents have to work.
Yeah, but that jobs. That myth needs to be busted.
Well, that's what I'm asking. What did you guys
But learn? Well, but the other thing is, too, is like that's kind of there's a framing to that question, right? And it's kind of framed the way politicians want people to think about complex social, political, and economic problems. It's like, I can solve it. Everybody who's run for president in my entire life claims that they have the solution to some complex problem that's been plaguing the country ever since whatever that institution is popped up, right? So I don't have a solution for the inner city. You know, there, it's not, and the inner city is not my responsibility. It's not my culture. You know, I would have to be a complete insane person to think that I could solve that problem or formulate a way to solve that problem. I've never lived in the inner city. I worked with inner city kids. I saw the environments they came from, places where success is almost punished. I've worked in places with like, you know, poor rural whites. So, and those two cultures, it's not a race thing. You know, it is very much a class thing. And those two groups have almost identical sets of problems.
Right.
And they don't really, but they only focus, like they came together in this school, this boarding school where I worked, where we took the poor rural whites from Vermont in the inner city, mostly minorities. It was just an instant race war because that was the most superficial thing that they could identify, and they didn't realize that they had all the same problems, all the same concerns, all the same needs, all the same unmet needs. Mm. But, you know, whenever somebody says to me, okay, well, what's your solution for the entire, and I'm not saying that you're saying this, but like, this is a conversation I've had many times with people who, I guess, speak that political language, I would have to be a madman to think that there would be a solution. My niche inside this problem is to direct people towards these options. If I could find a way to do that in inner city or with the rural poor across America, if I thought I had a solution that would work for them, I would be public about it. But I think those are deep-seated cultural problems. And the government's been trying to fix them in all of those places for 50 years and only making them worse.
So well, they always think that it's throwing money at the problem, but they indeed. Still keep they in the problem. Here's a we're talking about problems all the time. The problem is what the definition of success is for a school, and it always has to do with academic and testing, and mm-hmm. only two specific topics: math and language, quote unquote language. I see a solution in valuing human connection as one of the hallmarks of what an education entails. Because I'll be honest, as a teacher, like you're not going to connect fully with every single student you have, but there might be someone down the hall who connects awesome with that kid.
Right, right.
So find the vibrations, find the connections that are made, and let those people hang out together. Because if you got people who are on the same vibe or on the same when they're on that same trip, then anything can happen.
And I think that for more of these like really struggling and distressed groups that we're talking about, if there's ever going to be a solution, it's going to have to come from within those own communities. And it's going to mean saying no to the support and the finger quotes help that they get from the government that just drives them deeper into desperation and dependence.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like what we've discovered on this trip to a very limited extent, but I think that we sort of saw enough of America in terms of, even though it was really fast, it was a glimpse of America. Like, I'm not trying to make any broad sweeping statements, but what we've seen is that one podcast by Brett is interpreted by 15 different groups slightly differently and immediately sort of adapted and made malleable into what it needs to be. You know, maybe it's a school where the population is a lot smaller. Maybe that's the solution for one community. You know, maybe the solution is that it's an individual who understands that both his parents work and so he can't be homeschooled. So he has to find the skills to and the confidence. I think that's a big thing, is that the level of confidence of those we met who are unschooled or we heard about who are unschooled and those who are in school is day and night. So it comes down to every individual. But what we know is the more information we put out there, the more of this discussion that we're having across spaces like YouTube and Reddit and whatever it happens to be. I mean, the reason that the show is called School Sucks is because that is the sentiment. And that's been the sentiment since at least the 70s, if not well before then.
It's the most common feedback that I got when asking students their opinion about school.
School sucks.
Yeah. Or this, you know, this sucks. I hate this. You know, and I think most parents know that. And a lot of the people that I talk to that do alternative forms of education, whether it's home education or sending their kid to some alternative school, they get a lot of judgment and some, like, even outright condemnation from friends and family
sure.
about doing this.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the people who are really judgy and really negative about that, something in their minds is like, oh, shit, I could have done that. And I could be doing that if I just was a little less on autopilot about my kids' own education. Because it's like, I get the fact that like mom and dad both work. There's two car payments. There's a mortgage. Dad has problems at work. Is dad going to get a promotion? Mom doesn't know if she wants to have another baby. We also better figure out what Richie is going to do from ages 5 to 18. Well, there's this place called school that everyone agrees is education.
They're already paying for it.
That we already pay for, that everybody in this neighborhood seems perfectly happy to send their kids and call it education. So if we just do that, that enormous problem is solved. I mean, I think it almost takes some kind of deliberate awareness.
Yeah, because the problem isn't obvious. Like, I don't think, do you go with Lucas? Do you go to, like, play groups and things like that yet?
He just plays with his cousins, really.
Okay, well, you know.
I mean, sometimes when in the summer, there's kids in the street, and he goes out and we play. And,
so maybe you'll meet the other parents. I don't think any of the parents of 2 or 3 year olds or 4 year olds are thinking, oh, shit, we've got this massive problem of what's going to happen.
It's a problem already solved. I mean, is that what you were going to say?
Well, no. I mean, I'm thinking about what kind of footage you have and the people that you've talked to. What are those stories of empowerment that parents have had? Like, that's the main thing. You said it yourself. It's going to be coming from those grassroots sources. Like, what empowering knowledge have you gotten that you could give to a parent in an inner city or in a suburb and tell them, look, you say this to this specific person and something will happen.
Well,
and it's always has to do with legalities. It's always has to do with the law, right? Like, what kind of legal empowerment do parents have to say, you know what, something's wrong here and it needs to...
It depends on where they are. Depends a lot on where they are. I mean, and I've learned a lot of really strange things, like the most small L liberal, meaning free, state as far as like home education is concerned is New Jersey. I mean, there's plenty of other states that are up there. There's some states that are really restrictive about what you can do.
How did that happen? Why New Jersey?
I'm actually not sure because it seems to go against everything that I would assume about it. They have a super powerful, I mean, just the political culture there. Plus they have a super powerful teachers union.
Right.
But the law aspect was just one part of your question, I think, right?
Yeah, what other empowering stories or empowering tools that parents and community leaders can learn from where you are?
Some of the content that we've produced and some of the experiences that we've had, like several come to mind. There's a place called the Circle School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So my friend Tony Myers and I, we went there. One of the most shocking things about it was teenagers came up to adults they didn't know and said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so," looking us in the eye. "Who are you? Why are you here? Can I show you around?" Mm-hmm. It was almost like from somebody who had taught in, you know, private school where a bunch of things were imposed on kids and public school where everything's imposed on kids and working with that population early in my career, this was like almost like bizarro world.
Right.
The teenagers would say, "Oh, a new adult. I'll go see what he's about." When I was a teenager, school created this antagonistic relationship with adults. Not even just adults in the school. It was like every adult, like my own parents. It reminds me of John Taylor Gatto, right? If John Taylor Gatto was still a young enough man to be teaching now, he'd be arrested and thrown in jail. Because what he used to do is he'd say, these kids sit in this room all day. They have tremendous untapped potential. They can't access any of that just staring at a wall or listening to me talk. So he'd start like finding adults that he trusted in the community or vetting adults that he didn't know. And he would say, "Okay, you two, you're with this guy today. Sign him out of school." Sneak his own kids out of school, pretty much.
Yeah.
Much to the chagrin of the administrators sometimes. Still one teacher of the year, I think, while he was doing this.
"Hey, you want to be a journalist? Go sneak off. You're going to go hang out with the New York Times for the day."
But he would connect kids to adults and build positive mentoring relationships with adults. Mm-hmm. So every single one, and this isn't just the Circle School, right? This is just one anecdote, but every single one of these kids who don't have to be in those buildings all day, what about socialization? Okay. How about having access to the entire world of people of all different ages where you have access to mentors and other people have access to you as a mentor? You're 14, you know how to play the guitar. Maybe you team up with this 7-year-old since you guys don't have to sit on opposite ends of a concrete building all day learning Spanish.
And being competitive in the hallways.
Right.
Mm. Right.
And, or bullied. Or,
right, all that.
So I mean...
There's a pecking order is my point.
Right.
I could give you so many stories like that the parents who had had their kids in school and then took them out and watching their kids flourish. But that was one of the most powerful things that I saw is that... You know, people just having access to the real world
people having access to people.
It's, yeah, human, exactly.
Human connection again. Like, who do you connect with? What are your shared interests with someone who knows how to do it?
Right.
And is so, doing it out there in the world.
So there's a couple of things at this point I want to bring up. The first is when we're in New Mexico and we were speaking to Michael. And Michael pointed out that, yeah, that whole two cars, a mortgage, all that pressure, yeah. Like that maybe we can call the cost of living stress or mortgage stress or whatever fancy macroeconomic.
That people aren't taught to deal with either.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things that we're, yeah. we have to deal with to be successful or even unsuccessful, but, you yeah. deal with them. And we're not taught about these things. Yeah. There's a common theme there.
And so he's struggling because he knows that, well, not struggling. He's wrestling with the fact that he knows that he could be spending more hours in his home office working and making more money for his family. But you only get to be a parent once, you know. 4 to 14 is only 10 years. And that can go by so quickly. Mm-hmm. And the thing he pointed out is that he can always work way more when she's 18. He'll still be young enough, you know. Mm-hmm. She's 8 now. He's like 32, 33. So he's still got another 20 years once she's old enough to not want to spend every day with him. But while she does want to spend every day with him, why not make himself available?
Yeah.
So that's one way of looking at it.
Right. Well, and they also had the whole, I'm sure they had the same thing in Australia, but in America it was like in the 40s, post-World War II era, it became the avant-garde for women to go into the workplace. And yeah. that way the kids went into daycare and the school had more time with them. Yeah. Maybe they go to school early. Maybe they stay after school late. Now you got everybody out of the house. It's total divide and conquer.
Yeah.
Right? So there's that.
Yeah. And I mean, like, burglaries probably went up statistically.
Right. After think that about happened. That. You got all these houses sitting around empty all the time. And then police forces could get bigger to defend against that.
So, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to someone, to the school system.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like...
But it's not the students.
With... Even with what John Taylor Gatto did, yeah, he couldn't do it the exact same way that he did it then. Now, of course not. But then if you take him back 30 years into the past, would the situation be the same that, oh, he could get away with it? Like, are we really in a linear situation where we're constantly progressing in a straight line? Yeah, exactly. So there's no guarantee that John Taligato's method is one method. It's right. rooted in a period of time.
We do the same
time.
Thing today, but without having kids leave the classroom, it's like they could have Skype conversations.
Exactly. So there's
coaching
there's,
or whatever.
There's a thousand ways to do it, and I think that's what the thesis of this show, of this documentary is that, yeah, school sucks. Your situation sucks. Even if you're an adult and you've got student loan debt and you're working some shitty cubicle job where, you know, those four walls are not just around you, but three of them are a lot closer to you all of a sudden.
Or you just even have learning deficits. Like, you realize what your deficits are after being $100,000 in debt with a fucking political science degree.
Right.
Yeah. And you don't know anything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that was the other thing that I wanted to talk about.
That what people really need to learn isn't being taught within those four walls.
Yeah. And that's the crisis and opportunity with Jordan Peterson is because if we're talking about solutions, well, I think the solution that we're trying to offer, if we are able to prescribe anything, and I don't think we should, what position are we in to prescribe anything to anybody else? We don't know enough about
it. We just let them know stuff exists and they can check it out if they want to. And
so that's our stance. It's like, hey, you're in a tube. You know, but look, if you look closely at the walls of that tube, they're actually doors. And you can just walk right out of that tube if you want.
And that's not, and that message isn't for everybody. Because I could go to these cutting edge alternative schools and I could still find a room of kids who are teenagers. And this happened at one place. I was getting a tour of a school. Learning center. And there's a room where there's a bunch of negative teens clustered together. It stinks in there. It's hot. It's like a boiler room, you know, like the stock trading room. Guys just sit at the computers all day. Most of them don't even look up. Most of them don't even acknowledge me. You know, one of them goes, "You're here to tour the school? Oh, I feel bad for you." Those people exist for whatever reason, you know, whether it's parenting, something to do with their environment, their diet, what kind of media they consume. it's not my job to develop a solution for them. Yeah. It's my job to let them know that the alternative exists. And if they say, then fine. But I'd rather have those kids in a free environment than all of those kids who could flourish in a free environment trapped in the compulsory environment, right?
Right.
There are some kids who, for whatever reason, are not going to say, now that I have all this freedom, it's very important that I develop a purpose and manifest it in reality, right? That's actually probably a minority of people who will do that.
Yeah.
And I've said this several times along the way. If I could push a button and every young person could just pursue their purpose, our economy would collapse in 5 years.
Yeah. And
there would be just garbage fires everywhere, you know, if that was the case.
And there already are, Brett. I mean, that's the other parallel that's happened on this trip is watching things like Charlie Rose being accused of sexual indecency or impropriety.
What about George H.W. Bush?
Yeah, you know, he's
so respectful.
His favorite magician or whatever.
How did Oswald do that?
Yeah.
So, you know, the end of the show is coming up, see?
Yeah, I know, but I do want to sneak this in because I really think it's important.
That's what George H.W. Bush said.
Yeah, no, not that. the thing with what's happened, and we were talking about this in Richmond, and this is kind of like the Civil War 2.0 antecedent kind of paranoia maybe coming out. But we are deliberately not offering a solution. We're deliberately not trying to stand here and say, we've figured it all out. Just do what we say and you're fine. Instead, we're saying, you're a unique individual. Okay, maybe we're not going to call you a snowflake because that's got the wrong connotations to it now. But you are a unique individual with unique interests and with unique opportunities to make something yourself in the community. You know, and that's almost like the Frankfurt School argument. To some extent, and without going down that rabbit hole. But what I'm trying to say is someone like Jordan Peterson is getting 500,000 views on his YouTube videos every time he releases them, maybe even more. I mean, he makes $60,000 a month on Patreon from like 4,000 subscribers. So how many people out there are within his now immediate sphere of influence? And so the problem is, even if he does everything right now that he's got this huge platform to speak on, if not him, who? Someone is going to come along and figure out they can mobilize this army.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, right. You know.
Because you treat, you know, I mean, and this is a really good point because both sides are playing this game right now. You know, like both the main political sides are playing this game. Yeah. Donald Trump was a savior for people. Like, are you angry? Are you ready for the solution?
Are you tired of the Clintons?
It's Trump. Right. But on the same, on the other side too, the left is doing this thing like, hey, are you a revolutionary who's tired of the status quo? Yeah. Well, then join Al Gore and give money to UNESCO and start a revolution, you know?
Yeah.
It's like they are weaponizing that spirit in people to use it to
This is eugenics.
Right. I mean, but they're taking that and they're steering it. It's cybernetics is what it really is. It's the rudder that just goes, look at all these people.
Steering the ship of state.
Nobody, or herding the rocks. Cats. You know, it is like successfully herding cats. It's like, are all of you individual, you know, seeking out your own path, your own volition? Well, here's how you all do it, you know? It's really successful management of people.
Well, you see the two opposing sides in Charlottesville. You see the Antifa, you see the alt-right, and most people don't agree with either of those two groups.
Those two groups are minorities.
Yeah.
They're like the ends of the vice, though. Everyone else is like in between those two extreme views, and they use it to squeeze.
A social justice warrior is not a belief system. It's a behavior. Nazis marching in Charlottesville is not a belief system. It's a behavior. Antifa is not a belief system. It's a behavior. And they're all useful barometers for how a lot of people think, but they're not like disaffected or maladjusted enough to actually act on those thoughts, right?
Yeah.
So if that number of people will march in Charlottesville to protect Robert E. Lee statue, right? How many people like that actually exist?
Right.
Or if there's people willing to use violence and acid attacks and throw bricks and bottles with explosives at people who act like the Robert E. Lee defenders.
Yeah.
How many people share their anger or their idea for a solution? You know,
But it's the start of a mob mentality, and that's always dangerous because...
Right. But the thing that gives all those people that handle right. is school, right? Because they're looking for an answer. They're looking for an authority to give it to them.
Russian education system.
Exactly. What, there's a great quote in marketing. I can only paraphrase it. Like, people will throw money at anyone who says, you know, follow me and I'll show you how to be happy. You know, I'll show you who's not making you happy. I'll tell you how we'll punish them together, and then we'll follow me down the path to happiness.
So the danger,
that's some Machiavelli shit right there.
Yeah, the danger is that yes, maybe in the '70s school seemed doomed, you know, and maybe when the internet first became popular in the, you know, during the .com period, yeah. and so school seemed doomed. I mean, things like Khan Academy came out, but the thing about social media. And the thing about why social media is almost a different qualitative entity to what the predecessors are is that within social media, it's inherently communicative. Therefore, it is really hard to continue to herd those cats,
mm-hmm.
right? So because they can fact check the teacher in the classroom. You know.
If they're allowed to have their phone.
No, not necessarily. I mean, a lot of schools have iPads as a learning tool. So,
yeah. Yeah, but it's very much got the...
First page of Google is not necessarily...
No, sure, but what I'm saying is the first
one of those links.
Yeah, the first page of Google didn't exist when I was in primary school. You know, and that's what I'm saying. Kids in primary school are able to fact check their teachers. Yeah. Like that's,
but only if that information is easily available on the internet and promoted to the top of the searches. Well, otherwise, it's Oswald.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. I get it. But
thinking you're getting informed from school or watching the news is like thinking you're getting rock hard abs from watching an infomercial.
But everyone's going to start somewhere rich.
What's that?
Everyone has to start somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the point, is you're recognizing people with starting points, and it's not the end of their journey, but when they bump into these ideas, that's where their real journey outside of schooling begins.
Yeah.
Self-learning and autonomy.
And that's the thing.
Self-reliance,
and
self-confidence.
So your documentary, it's like not a roadmap, but milestones along the path of self-knowledge or self.
Cognitive liberty.
Yeah, I guess.
That's a really good way to put it, because I've thought about creating a product called, you know, like a roadmap to self-education.
Milestone one.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a very difficult thing to say, like, here's the map you have to follow. But well, you can put...
Here's a map, here's like a map of the terrain.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a GPS. It's just the map.
Right.
You are here. Where would you like to go?
And maybe there's some suggestions. There's some route suggestions based on what we've learned from creating this content and doing this show.
There's a metaphor here somewhere.
Yeah.
Choose your own adventure. Here's a map. Here's the possibilities. Here's some success stories. Here's some failure stories.
Right.
Yeah. You get to choose.
Yeah. The very first podcast released on School Sucks Across America was with Rich, and it was called Making a Map. And so I liked how it came full circle and that topic came up again tonight. And, of course, I just wanted to thank Rich for having me here twice.
You're very welcome.
Being such an awesome cheerleader on this tour and, you know, for even, like, doing tech support and emotional support along the way.
I loaned you
over
an
the
easy
phone,
pass.
Loaning me the easy pass.
Right. I'm sure there'll be some point where I need you to hold a camera or something. Well, we began the show with Man's Search for Meaning, and Brett's a man who's been out searching for his meaning, and I think you guys conveyed it.
I'm glad that we got to start here. This was the first stop. It's the last stop. I feel like that's really appropriate. Hey, if you're a patron, just keep listening. There's going to be a pre-show where we talk about Conspirator and the JFK assassination, in case you haven't heard anything about that, and then a couple other outtakes that I'll introduce. And at the very, very end, because today's show had a fair amount of vulnerability in it, and I also talked about other people's meltdowns,
I thought I would share with you one of mine. It's a drive journal that I never released. It is as I am coming into San Francisco on a Sunday night and encountering the traffic and some of the driving practices there for the first time. It's not my proudest moment, but it's a snapshot of, you know, one of the challenges I encountered along the way. To everybody else, thank you so much for listening, and we will be back next week with something exciting and new.